Good morning, everyone. How did you sleep?
You look terrible. So we are now in Ruth chapter 3, moving towards the end. The weekend has gone by so quickly, hasn't it? For all of you, for all of us. And we have one more session, the memorial meeting after this, and then we have to go home. Sometimes when we come down from the top of that mountain, having seen the transfiguration, or whatever it is that we've taken away from a Bible study, it can be a little bit depressing going back to the everyday reality and troubles and day-to-day problems that we have to deal with, but that's the way it is until we get to the time of the kingdom. And then it will be like a Bible school every day for us. Then, Lord willing, we shall be, at that point in time, given eternal life. And then we shall never stop working. We won't need to rest. One thing you should bear in mind, young people, is that the kingdom and life in the truth is all about work, not escaping from work or getting out of work. It is about engaging in and becoming more versatile at performing different kinds of work. And the work is always service. It's not for your ego, and it's not always seen. Sometimes it's the quiet, behind-the-scenes work that is done by people that is the most significant work of all. So get used to work if you're a bit of a stranger to it at this stage in your life. Get familiar with work, because if you're going to be a Christadelphian, you're going to have to learn how to work. Chapter 3, Naomi said to her, "My daughter, shall I not seek rest for thee?" Now the Hebrew word for rest is manoach. In the story of Samson, his father's name is Manoah. That's the same Hebrew word. And it means a place of rest. A place of rest. Naomi looks at this lovely, hard-working. She's not a lazy bones. This is a hard-working girl who's not even related to her and who treats her with such love and concern and has exposed herself to hard work and to risk in order to care for her. She looks at her and she wants to give her some kind of stability in her life, because she knows she's not going to live long. She's lost her children. She has no children anymore. But this young woman has become like her daughter, her child, and now she wants to take care of her. Now you realize this is Naomi sacrificing herself, because there's no guarantee if she finds a husband for her that the husband will care to have Naomi in his house. So Naomi is now taking on risk because of her love for her part of the ecclesia, or the other part of the ecclesia. And the ecclesia consists of Naomi and Ruth, if you look at them as a little unit, a little ecclesia, a little family unit. So the love that we have for each other sometimes involves self-sacrifice, not having our own way, not doing what is always good for us, but allowing other people's interests to be the primary thing. And service in the truth, work in the truth, is not about what is comfortable and easy and convenient for you. It's putting the other person first. And that's not something that's natural to us at all. Certainly isn't natural to young people and to teenagers. Right? So when we get down to verse 2, it says, "And now is not Boaz our kinsman with whose maidens thou wast?" Now the word kindred is translated in the Revised Version, kinsman. It's the Hebrew word goel. If you spelt it in English, it would be G-O-E-L. And it means the next of kin. Now that was a special relationship. It didn't have to be your brother. It was just the next male member that you could say was your relative. So if you didn't have any sons, if your husband was dead, then the next closest male relative was the goel, the kinsman. And the job of the kinsman is described in the book of Leviticus and in other places. And it involved the following duties. If you sold your property in order to pay debts and then found yourself in a situation where you had to, for instance, sell yourself into a contract as a contract slave or servant, and then you couldn't pay to get yourself out of it. It was the job of your kinsmen to come and redeem you, to get you out of bondage, out of slavery, so that you could go free. Also, if somehow you were out in a field working with somebody, and they killed you by mistake, or they killed you intentionally, right? The job of the next of kin would be to avenge your death if he could catch you, if he could find you, right? If, for instance, you killed somebody by mistake, and you fled, and you went to a Levitical city of refuge, then you were safe. You were safe, and the goel could not come and kill you, because the city elders would stop you at the gate and say, you're not allowed to do that, this man is under our protection. But your job, as the goel, was to redeem, to buy people back, to pay their debts for them, or to avenge them if they had been killed by someone else. The work of the redeemer, the redeeming aspect of the next of kin, is something that's a shadow, a foreshadowing, a type. It's a picture in advance of the work of Christ, who bought us out of sin and death. How? Through his work, his death, and his resurrection. And through our baptism into those things, our willing association with him, our desire to be part of his bride, his wife. We've submitted ourselves at his feet. We've been baptized, washed, and associated ourselves with the hard work that he did that led to his resurrection, that led to the condemnation of flesh and sin and mortality and all of these things. So, when we go further, her mother-in-law says to her, I know what he's doing now. He's winnowing barley tonight in the threshing floor. Now, she was an old lady, but she seems to have been very plugged into what was going on. And she knew exactly what his schedule was, where he was, and what he was doing that day. She knew the schedule very well indeed. Like many of our sisters can know schedules. Sometimes, husband hasn't got a clue what's going on. Wife says next day, have you been doing any studies? Husband says, what? You realize you're exhorting tomorrow, don't you? Now, what? And so the husband runs downstairs and throws together and reheats an exhortation that he knows he's given someplace else, but hasn't given at the ecclesia that he's exhorting at tomorrow. Sometimes if you want to know what's going on in the ecclesia and who's marrying who, ask your daughter. Because the girls know everything about all of that stuff, when the husbands and the dads and the sons haven't got a clue about what's going on, because they don't keep plugged into those issues. And so the life of our community without our sisters would be very poor and empty indeed. And as we see and know from experience, half the time we wouldn't know what we were doing because nobody would be there to remind us as brethren. So this would never work as a community of brethren, ever. But as a community of equals, brothers and sisters together, with different roles, yes, but equals in the sight of God and treating each other as equals, then we have a wonderful harmony together as men and women. She's plugged in and she knows what's going on. And she has identified in her mind, not all the young men all over the place. And there must have been abundant young men. And by this point in time, all the city knew about this girl. Right? And here's a funny thing about people. Right? We talked about some of those issues that people can treat each other in a way that is inappropriate because of background differences and so on. But the funny thing is, many, many people who may have an instantaneous default reaction that's not the best reaction in the world and that might hurt you will themselves turn around and learn from it. And when somebody else comes along, they'll give them a better break because of their interaction with you and because of how you handled it in a forgiving and a brotherly or a sisterly way without holding on to bitterness and a grudge. Such and such treated me like this and I'm angry and I can't let it go. If you treat them in a loving, warm way, that makes an impact on many people's hearts. So when the next person comes along, it's a completely different interaction because of how you interacted with them. Boaz was the son of Rahab the harlot. And no doubt the people that were in the gate, the government of the town, the city council, had seen what a tremendously loving, gifted, and giving, generous-hearted brother he was. Maybe these were some of the very people that had grown up with him and said nasty things to him as a kid. When Ruth the Moabitess comes along, maybe there's a bit of reticence about judging and condemning, based on what they had learned with Boaz and what they had seen happen with Rahab. As it turns out, the people in the very gate of the city acknowledged that Ruth is a virtuous woman. Now that was a big deal. That was a really, really big deal. That's what it was. That would be the equivalent of somebody growing up in the deepest, most red-necked territory of Alabama, referring to a young black woman as a profoundly fine and wonderful Christian woman, that they would be glad to have marry their child, if you could imagine such a thing. That's exactly what this was, that they would acknowledge this. But Naomi is a very wise woman. And in spite of the fact that by this stage, many young men, poor and rich, all of a sudden had this very positive interest in Ruth, she's not interested as a mother-in-law in them. Instead, the more she has learned and thought about Boaz, the more she has realized, that's the man for my girl. Right? Now, this was a day in which marriages were arranged by parents for children. Your mom and dad got together with somebody else's mom and dad and decided who you were going to marry. And they decided based on some interesting criteria, some of which nobody ever found out. Moms would go, for instance, and they would have an interview with the girl's mother. And the girl would come in nicely dressed and would bring in food and serve the mother-in-law prospectively. And the mother-in-law would do a full scan, up and down, all the way through. Up and down. How is she walking? What is she shaped like? What kind of eyes does that girl have? Did she look at me? When she looked at me, was there defiance in that look? Was there a smattering of too much curiosity? Does this look like she'll be a challenging person to deal with when I have to have her in my home or when she's married to my son? Look at those nails. They look awfully well tended. I wonder if this girl knows how to work with her hands. And then they might ask the girl a question. And depending on how the girl asked, as a woman is able to, they would be able to draw an Encyclopedia Britannica's worth of conclusions about the girl, based on that one interaction, the looks, the way she stood. She stands a little bit too tall in the saddle, that girl. She sits too tall. Something about that I don't like. I don't think this is the right one for my boy, right? So you were on pins and needles. The girl before the visit was as nervous as anything. And, according to theory, you never saw the boy until you married him. Now, how'd you like that, girls? Of course you'd like that, wouldn't you? Don't know what you're going to get, what he looks like, any of that stuff, until the day that you get married. That was the custom of the time. And some people think that there was wisdom in that, you know. Right? Marriage came first and love came after, and love was something that developed over time as you grew to know each other. And it was felt at the time that the parents had the wisdom to make choices based on experience of life that the young people didn't. Of course, we know in this society that would never at all work. And this age, it wouldn't work. But that's how it was done then. So Naomi is doing what a mother does. She's selecting somebody, but she knows there is a connection that will work on the conscience of Boaz. She throws a grapple hook into him that has to do with his relationship to them as the next of kin. And the responsibility of the next of kin was to care for the family, to redeem the family out of trouble, to make sure that people were looked after. That was his responsibility. And this was a responsible man. Right? But Naomi's intentions are more complex than this. They're more wide-ranging. She's not just looking for an appeal to him to be the kinsman, the goel. She also wants that this man would marry her daughter-in-law, who she adores, because she cannot think of a better man for her, right? And so she says to her, "Wash thyself therefore and anoint thee, and put thy raiment upon thee, and get thee down to the floor, the threshing floor, but don't make yourself known to any man until he's done eating and drinking." So Ruth, the Gentile intended, washes herself. Then she goes to see the man in whom is strength, who has now come to the end of a period of hard work. This is the end of barley harvest. And she says, "And it shall be when he lieth down that thou shalt mark the place where he shall lie. Thou shalt go in and uncover his feet and lay thee down." To lie at someone's feet, or to fall at someone's feet, was an act of total and complete submission and trust. She washes herself. She goes to the man at the end of his labor, and she submits to him completely. "And he will tell thee what thou shalt do." And she said unto her, "Are you crazy or something? That old fossil? Look at me. Do I look like I'm 45, 50 years of age? Have you taken a good look at him? He has more wrinkles than an elephant." That's not what she says. She said unto her, "All that thou sayest unto me, I will do." Isn't that amazing? Now, don't for a second think that Ruth didn't have a will of her own. Don't for a second think that she wasn't strong-willed enough to stand up for herself. If that girl was willing to go out into Jewish society and glean in somebody's field, and she had no clue what would happen to her, but she just did it on trust and faith in God, a God she didn't know until recently, she had lots of strength in her. So she could have said to her mother-in-law, "No, that's... I'd rather not do that, Mum. I really appreciate your advice, but I'm not doing that. That's not what I would like to do." Instead, she accepts her mother-in-law's direction, and she does what she asks her to do. Now, you are told as young people to obey your parents. And I know you don't like to hear it, but that is what the Word of God tells you to do. I'm not talking about obedience to things that are criminal or that are downright morally wrong. It's the workaday, everyday, irritating things your parents ask you and tell you to do that involve effort or that involve you accepting their guidance and direction. For you not to obey your parents, whether you like to hear it or not, is wrong. There's nothing right about it. And that is such a problem that it comes right in the middle of two passages having to do with social interactions that are vital for the stability of families and ecclesias. The relationship between husbands and wives, then the relationship between children and their parents, and the relationship between parents and their children, and employees and employers. And I know in Ephesians you point out that passage, and in Colossians, about the fathers irritating their children and criticizing them, and so on and so forth. And you're right. But the fact of the matter is, Scripture does not give you the legitimate right to nail your parents down to their responsibilities. What it does is it focuses on your need to look after your responsibilities so that you listen to your parents. If you are disobedient and dismissive and disrespectful towards the parent that you can see, how will you act with God, the parent you cannot see? So obedience is not something that's an option. It's not a frill. It's not something that you enter into when you're getting along with your parents. It is, in fact, a responsibility that you have. So Ruth sets the example, not just as a believer and what believers ought to do, and an example for all of us as baptized people, but she also sets an example as a daughter, as the child of someone else. And that wasn't even her mother. It wasn't even her mother. So it's a real good lesson for all of us, and especially for you as young people. And then it says, she went down unto the threshing floor and did according to all that her mother-in-law bade her. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk, and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of corn. Isn't that interesting? The man in whom is strength, who reminds us of the man that God made strong for himself out of the Psalms, Christ, gets to the end of a terrific effort, a labor. And now he goes and he lies down and he falls asleep. And the results of his labor are right there where he's sleeping. There are piles of barley all around him. He's sleeping right where the accomplishment resides. This young Gentile woman has washed herself. She now comes in. She creeps in. She uncovers his feet. Maybe he was covered over with an overcoat. And she lies down at his feet. Well, what does that remind you of? Surely it reminds you of baptism. It reminds you of the submission that we demonstrate towards Christ when we are baptized, when we're washed. And what's the lying down at the feet? It's the submission part. So what then is the man lying down in the barley? It's Christ's work of atonement into which we are baptized. At the end of his work, he had accomplished his death, and the resurrection came after. When we are baptized, we're baptized into his death. There we are, right down in the atonement. And then we come up out of it, and it's a symbolic resurrection with a view to the resurrection to come down the line when Christ returns to the earth. And we receive eternal life. So all of these pictures in this chapter, and the chapter before, with the bread and the wine and the parched corn, remind us of Christ and the relationship between Christ and his bride. But all the way through, the prominent emotion is what? Love. The love of Naomi for Ruth. The love of Ruth for Naomi. The love of Boaz as a brother, caring person, for Naomi and Ruth to take care of them. For her as a daughter. And then between them, Ruth and Boaz, as a husband and wife. Look what happens then. And she came softly and uncovered his feet and laid her down. And it came to pass at midnight that the man was afraid and turned himself, and behold, a woman lay at his feet. What does that remind you of? Tell me. Man wakes up and there's a woman at his feet. What does that remind you of? Who does that remind you of? Anyone? Hand up. I've got a room full of Americans and nobody can talk. Yes, little girl, who?
Adam.
Look at that. Adam woke up. Good for you. And there beside him was Eve. Right? He didn't know Eve was coming. So he must have been a bit afraid. What's a scary thing? There's a woman. You know, oh! And he says, who are you? I'm Ruth, your handmaid. And you can just imagine her heart is in her throat because she doesn't know what's going to happen. But you know, she does love this man. She has come to love him. She never thought somebody like him would be interested in her. Never thought it possible. Right? And Boaz never thought a girl like her would be interested in him. Because look what it says. She says to him, I am Ruth, thine handmaid. Spread therefore thy skirt over thine handmaid. That was a symbol. The spreading of the skirt over, of the garment over, meant to include the person in my life so that we are one flesh. I extend my protective wing over you. And isn't that what Boaz had said to her? May God, who you've come to trust in, cover you with his wings. He'd said that in chapter 2. Now he does it. She asks him to do it. Now there's an interesting thing, young man. Because what it means is that you as young men have a responsibility to treat the young women around you as Christ would treat his ecclesia, who gave his life for his ecclesia. He never pressured her for his pleasures. What he did was he gave his life for her. Now, is that how you treat the young women or the women around you? The girl that you're interested in? Do you treat her like that? Does he treat you like that? Because if he doesn't, he's not the right kind of person for you. You at the same time, young lady, have to be the right kind of girl. So a Ruth attracts a Boaz. A Boaz attracts a Ruth. And that's an important thing to bear in mind. Right? You cannot be an Orpah and feel that you are somehow going to snag a Boaz. You cannot be an Elimelech and think somehow you're going to catch a Ruth. Because if she has any wisdom, she will not take the bait. She will not fall for a fool. Are you a fool, young man? Are you a fool, young lady? What makes somebody a person of character and of strength and of real interest to intelligent Christadelphians is faith and ruggedness in the truth and being somebody who is not insubstantial, all about how you look, or all about having your pleasure desires met. All that stuff is, you know, that is the stuff that lowers you in the esteem of intelligent people. Right? So remember, get that feeling of desperation out of you. That if I do not do what this boy wants me to do, I will never find somebody else again because I'm not a pretty girl, or I'm not pretty enough, or I'm not smart enough. And therefore, I have to put up with whatever, and I have to give him what he'd like. Absolutely not. That's not true at all. Don't fall for that. Don't fall for that kind of reasoning. If that young idiot is not able to control himself and to pull himself back from pressuring you into sex before marriage, he is not worth a nickel. He's worth nothing. Don't fall for a fool like that. And if you are with somebody like that, dump him now. It's the best thing that you can do for yourself, for your self-esteem, for your sense of worth and value. Cut the links and hold yourself apart and wait for God to bring to you the right person. Because that kind of person is an idiot, a moron, an imbecile. He's all about his physical desires and needs. That's all he is. And any young man that is like that is not worth anything at all. And if that's what you like, young man, then you need to turn around and change. So Boaz and Ruth suddenly find each other, and she says to him, "Spread your skirt over me, for you are a goel. I want you to redeem us, but I also want you to marry me." So Ruth proposes to Boaz. And he said, "Blessed be thou of the Lord, my daughter, for thou hast showed more kindness in the latter end than at the beginning, inasmuch as thou followedst not young men, whether poor or rich." So the young men were now interested in her, not as somebody that they looked down on, or somebody that the riffraff among them might abuse in another field where nobody could defend her. Now they looked at, this is a girl I could marry. Oh, that's a good girl. That would be a good wife. She's a real sister. That's somebody who believes in God, and God is everything to her. And look how she looks after her ecclesia. Look at how she participates in caring for the needs of Naomi. That isn't even her daughter. That's not her mom. What a girl she is. Wow. That's what the young men thought. And Boaz looks at her and thinks, boy, if only I'd found a girl like that when I was young. But she's such a good girl. I hope she finds a good match. And then the girl comes and proposes to him. Imagine, a man who never thought he'd ever find anybody, ever. And did he sit down feeling sorry for himself and pouting? You know, I'm not tall enough, I'm not strong enough, I'm not handsome enough, I'm not smart enough. None of those things. And I'm bitter because I don't have someone. He just carried on with life. He was still full of the truth and full of the life of the ecclesia. And so did Ruth. Right? And now, all of a sudden, he's faced with the prospect that this girl who is worthy of being adored has now proposed to him and seriously wants to marry him. And he just erupts with joy. And he says, look, you realize what you're doing? This kindness you're doing for this old fossil is greater than anything you've done before, because it is the most remarkable thing of all. A young woman wouldn't have gone and married a middle-aged man of her own free will if she had the pick of all of the young men, rich or poor. But that's what she did. And it says, now, my daughter, fear not. I will do to thee all that thou requirest. For all the city of my people doth know that thou art a virtuous woman. Everybody was talking about her. She came in, she was a Moabitish damsel, with all the connotations that went with that. Now everybody is talking about, that's what our daughters should be like that girl over there, that girl that came from Moab, right? That's what our daughters should be like. And somebody's daughter was misbehaving or getting cantankerous or a bit, somebody's child was getting a bit brutish, they might say, remember Ruth, if that Moabitess girl can behave like that, how about you? Stop behaving like that. You should be more like this girl. So Ruth had become somebody that everybody knew about. And she didn't. She wasn't the kind of person that went about trumpeting a horn or boasting or any of that. The reputation of her service got out, of her work, of her obedience, of her humility, of her love, of her strong faith in Yahweh, the God of Israel. That's what got about, right? And then it says, now it is true that I am thy Goel. However, there is a Goel that is nearer than I. There is somebody that is nearer than I am that you haven't thought of. Tarry this night, it shall be in the morning, that if he will perform unto thee the part of a kinsman, then that's fine. But if he will not do the part of a kinsman to thee, then will I do the part of a kinsman to thee. Now another part of it was, when your next of kin died, then the kinsman would marry your widow and raise up children. The first child would be the child of the person that had died and would inherit his property. Now that took self-sacrifice, because you would have to go through the teenage years with somebody else's child that wasn't your own. Imagine that. It's tough enough with your own. Now you've got to raise somebody else's child. And the child that is being raised isn't going to be your child. He will inherit the property of his father. So you had to be a kind of loving person to say, I'm going to do it. I'm going to love this child, and I'm going to raise him as my own, though I know he is the son of my dead kinsman. But it's my responsibility, I will raise him, and then help him to look after his inheritance so that he does right by his dead father. That's what the kinsman did. Boaz knew there was somebody else that was nearer. Who was nearer to the Jewish people than Christ, who was there ahead of him? The law of Moses. The law of Moses couldn't redeem Israel. It was closer in relation to Israel than Christ was. But Christ came after. He had been promised before. He was taught about right in the middle of the law itself, in all the offerings of the lambs and the goats and the bullocks. Christ was taught about, and his sacrifice. And he was superior in every way to that unnamed kinsman. The kinsman has no name, because he's not important when compared to Boaz. Just like the law, when compared with Christ, was just a pathetic little structure that was wiped away completely after Christ came along. Now that might be a little hard for some of you younger ones to understand, but I know the older ones will have understood. where I was coming from on that. So when you look at the types and the shadows that are in operation in the book of Ruth, the next of kin, who is nearer than Boaz, could be nearer in the allegory, in the analogy, nearer in time. So the law was in force, nearer to Israel than Christ was. But when Christ came along, the law couldn't redeem anybody. Christ could. So the law said, sorry, I can't do anything. I can't really save you from death. And Christ said, and I can. And so anybody who wanted to live didn't live by the law anymore. They lived through Christ, through whom comes life and hope, not through the law. So that's what we could interpret it in that way if we were of a mind to. So, as the Lord liveth, lie down until the morning. And she lay at his feet until the morning. And she rose up before one could know another. In other words, right in the early, early dawn. And he said, let it not be known that a woman came unto the threshing floor. Also he said, bring the veil that is upon thee and hold it. And when she held it tight. She took the veil off her head and she held the veil tight. What does he do? He measures 80 pounds of grain into it. Now, young lady, can you lift 80 pounds? This girl could. So she's a pretty strong young lady. 80 pounds in a veil. Throws it over her back and takes it home. Now, what do the 80 pounds of grain represent? She takes something off her head. Right? And it's filled with grain. In the symbol, it's as if the grain consists of all of the truth of Scripture, all of the joys of fellowship, all of the comforts of our relationships in the truth. That is like 80 pounds of grain. In other words, it's an unbelievably large quantity of food that will last a very, very long time. And of course, the reason we've got that 80 pounds of grain in the veil of the Gentile bride is because it has to last 2,000 years at least. We're still making use of that grain now. Right now, the grain is the word of God that's being taught to you. Right? So there she is. She takes this grain home. And when she came home, her mother-in-law is up. She's been up all night. Naomi never went to bed. Praying, what's going on? She gets to the door and the mother-in-law says, who are you? It's not who are you. It's what's your status. How did it go? That's what it means in the Hebrew. If you were to look at, well, the idiom or how they understood this Hebrew phrase, the literal translation is, who are you? But really, what the Hebrew was saying is, well, how did it go? What's your status now? Right? Are you engaged? Is he going to marry you? Did it work out? And it says, she told her all that the man had done to her. And she said, these 6 measures of barley, 80 pounds he gave to me. For he said to me, go not empty unto thy mother-in-law. Then said she, sit still, my daughter. Now that probably tells you about the condition that Ruth was in when she got back home. Right? She couldn't sit still. She probably couldn't slow down her speaking. She was probably in such a state of mind that what Ruth is saying, what Naomi is saying to her is, calm down. Just sit still. This man is not going to rest until everything works out. Because maybe Ruth had doubts in her mind. Maybe she thought, maybe it won't work out. There's this other kinsman. I don't know what's going to happen. I want to marry Boaz, not somebody else. So now you begin to see that Ruth does have a will. She does have a mind of her own. And she's upset. And Naomi, who is this woman of faith who has learned through her trials, says, just sit still and wait, my daughter, until thou know how the matter will fall. For the man will not rest until he has finished the thing this day. She knew Boaz. And she knew Ruth. That is why, young women, you need to go to the sisters in their 50s and their 60s to ask their advice on things, to learn from them, Titus chapter 2 says it's their responsibility to teach you, to train you about marriage, about raising children, about dating, about all these things. It's their responsibility. That's what Ruth learned from Naomi. All of these things about interaction and relationships. Because her mistakes, the problems she had had, the difficulties she had, trained her and made her very full of wisdom. And there's a great deal of wisdom in your older sisters. So take advantage of it.